As most of you know, we in the Hispanic community recently lost one of our most important leaders. Willie Velazquez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project, an organization which was formed by the National Council of La Raza, passed away. The Southwest Voter Registration and Education Project, under the leadership of Willie Velazquez, was responsible for registering over 2 million Hispanics and doubling the number of Hispanic elected officials. To honor the great work of Willie Velazquez, the National Council of La Raza would like to dedicate this 20th anniversary conference in memory of Willie Velazquez. At this moment, I would like to introduce his successor. He's got big shoes to fill, which is a very trite expression, but in the case of Willie, it does really fit. From San Antonio, Mr. Andy Hernandez.
Thank you. It is good to be here among friends. And as I entered into the banquet room this afternoon and met with people and saw people I hadn't seen in some time, it made me think about how far we've come, in the last 20 years, how far we've come politically in the last 20 years. For just 20 years ago, Hispanics were a people who had the least participation in the electoral process in this country. They were the least registered, and of those small number that were registered, they turned out the least of any other group in this country. 20 years ago, we had large numbers and little political power. 20 years ago, we were actually going down in our voter registration. From 1972 to 1974, voter registration among Hispanics actually went down, it dropped, which was a pretty remarkable achievement given the fact that our population at the same time was booming. 20 years ago, the number of elected officials throughout this country and throughout the Southwest was counted. Less than 600 elected officials in all this nation, even in areas where we were a majority of the population. 20 years ago, a short 20 years back, there was little respect for the Hispanic vote on the part of politicians. We had a hard time getting people to even answer our phone calls, much less show up to our banquets. Now, 20 years later, look how far we've come. Hispanics have gone from being the least registered, those that participated least in this society, to now, according to the U.S. Bureau of the Census, now I want to underline that, now the National Council is saying this, it's not Southwest voters saying this, as the U.S. Bureau of the Census now says that Hispanics are the fastest growing group when it comes to registering and voting in this country. We are now the fastest. Now, there's over 3,000 Hispanic elected officials throughout this country, most of them in the Southwest. And now, no national politician, no statewide politician, no congressional candidate will think of running in this country, in the Southwest, without respecting the Hispanic vote. There's respect for our vote across this land. Now, all that was the work that we did. We being the Hispanic leadership, we being the Hispanic community. Through our institutions, through the National Council of La Raza, through Southwest Voter, through NALEO, through our own institutions that we built with our energy and our talent and our skill, we have mainstreamed politically in the life of this country. It's not a question anymore of whether or not we've arrived politically. That has been done. That question is settled. We have arrived politically in this country so that now our voters respect it, what we say is listened to, and in fact, The fact of the matter is, not only do the decision makers and the politicians listen to what we have to say, but we are becoming the politicians and we are becoming the decision makers. And what we have to say doesn't always have to be listened to by others. What we have to say needs to be and is heard by others in the general community. That will continue. We have arrived politically in this country. We do have political power, such that Hispanics now will probably be the decisive vote in this next presidential election. Not probably, will be. If you look at the concentrations of Hispanics, if you look at their concentrations in Texas and California, in New York and Illinois, here in New Mexico, in key electoral states in this presidential election, Hispanics, perhaps by faith or providence, are strategically positioned to be the swing vote. Over 1 million voters registered to vote in Texas. Over 1.2 million in California. By November, 1.3 million in Texas. By November, 1.4 million in California. That's close to 700,000-800,000 votes cast in those states respectively. I'm telling you, friends, we will be the decisive vote in this election. Now, people have asked, how is it that Hispanics went from being that group that participated the least to where they are today? And frankly, the answer is simple. There isn't any magic to it. There wasn't any grand scheme about it. Hispanics are now moving into the political mainstream because their issues and their concerns are being addressed. Because our politics now, Hispanic politics now, reflects the hopes and aspirations of our people. And I think that's really what we need to look at for the next 20 years. We've won and met the first challenge. We've met and won the first challenge. The first challenge was the gaining of political power in this country. This generation of leadership has done that. We have gained political power in this country. We have garnered it and gained it out of our own work and our own sweat and our own talent and our own wisdom and out of our own people's strength. But the second challenge for our politics is now the exercise of that power. And I think it's good to remember what brought us into being. What brought Southwest Voter into being? What brought the National Council into being? And what brought us into being 20 years ago was that we served to advocate and to interpret and to bring forth the hopes and aspirations of our people, of the Hispano people living in this nation. And those hopes and aspirations are no different than other Americans. For if Hispano politics doesn't stand for opportunity, and all that we fought for the last 20 years hasn't stood just for the basic value and ideal of opportunity, then I don't really know what we've stood for, because that's what we've been about. Opportunity for our children to have a good education. Opportunity for working class people to have a decent job at a decent wage so they can raise their families with dignity and respect. Opportunities for us to make our contribution in the culture and civilization of this great nation, to be who we were meant to be. If our politics doesn't stand for opportunity, then I really don't know what it has stood for these last 20 years. Our politics and what gave us birth were the hopes and aspirations of our people for justice, fairness under the law, fairness, just simple justice. And when we stand for justice, we don't mean just us justice. We mean justice for all Americans, for all people, those who come after us and those that went before us. If our politics and what National Council has stood for and what Southwest Voter has stood for hasn't stood for justice, then I really don't know what we've stood for over the last 20 years. We've stood for those things. And our politics and our institutions have stood for freedom. For freedom. The freedom to be whom God made us to be. Now, I happen to be a religious person. I believe that God made us who we are, that He made us Hispanic, that He made us Mexican, that He made us Chicano. Now, if God made us that way, I don't think anybody else has the right to tell us that we shouldn't be what God made us. That's an inalienable right. That's an inalienable right. I ain't going to go messing with what God has done. Now, there are those in this country that would mess with that. They tell us that our language is something that divides and not unites. They tell us that our language is something that keeps us out and not brings us in. They tell us that our language is somehow going to corrupt America, somehow going to bring it down, that our civilization and culture is somehow going to take away who we are. Well, you know, that's not the first time we've heard that in this country. Actually, we hear it quite often about other immigrants. If you look at what was being said at the turn of the century about their grandfather and their great-grandmother, it's practically what they're saying about us. That if these foreigners, if these immigrants, if these people get their way and allow themselves to be who they are, then this country is going to get weak, and we're going to be less, and we're going to be less American. Every expansion of freedom has created great resistance in this country. It should not surprise us that as Hispanics move into the political mainstream, as we exercise real political power, that there's going to be great resistance to that. Every expansion of freedom has created a counter-resistance to it. At the founding of this country, there was a big debate on whether or not property owners and non-property owners, who should get the vote. They said, you know, if you give people who don't own property the vote, this country's going to fall apart. Democracy will be weakened. Other countries will run over us. We won't be America. Well, those people who said that were wrong. They were wrong, and they gave non-property owners a vote. Then, on the question of slavery, they would say, well, you know, if you release the slaves, you're going to weaken the economy. You're going to change American culture. You were going to destroy Western civilization as we know it. And they were wrong about that. Every expansion of freedom has created a counter-reaction. And then when it came to the women getting a vote, my God, can you imagine women voting in this country? What implications that would have? It would turn the world upside down. America would stop being who she is. Great resistance. Great resistance to the expansion of freedom. And those people were wrong. And history looks back at them and says they were wrong because they stood against freedom and they stood against what America stood for. And now we have those in our country who say that Hispanic civilization, Hispanic culture, and Hispanic political power, if these people get political power, no telling what's going to happen. Banana Republic 3 revisited here in the United States, you know? You get that going on. If these people get, if they keep their language and keep who God made them to be, America won't be the same. We'll be weaker. We'll be divided. Well, friends, I'm going to tell you this. Those people are wrong. History is against them. American ideals are against them. In the next 20 years, it's going to be incumbent upon us not to forget why we came into being in the first place. If it wasn't for opportunity, and if it wasn't for justice, and if it wasn't for freedom, and if we can't be for those things in the next 20 years, then we shouldn't be. But I have an abiding faith in the Hispanic people in this country, in their hopes and dreams and aspirations. I believe that we will stand in the next 20 years for all those things, and that history will look back at this generation of Hispanos here in the Southwest and across this country, and we'll look back and say, here's a people who stood for what was best in America. Here was a people who stood for its values of freedom and justice and opportunity, and who in doing so made America better. That's what the National Council of La Raza is doing. That's what Southwest Voters is doing. That's what Naleo is doing. That's what all our institutions are doing. We are making America better, not just for Hispanics, but for America, because we call her back home to what made her great. And that's the challenge of the next 20 years, to keep calling her back home and make her great. Thank you.
I just want to really pick up from where Andy Hernandez left off, because what he said was right. You have achieved political power. I'm standing and living proof of that. I got elected in 1982 and again in 1986 because of the support of the Mexican-American community in Texas. Thanks to you, I have a paying job, and I'm grateful for that. But more important, is the second phase of where Andy indicated he's going to carry the Southwest Voter Registration organization, and that is into the stage of what our message is, being in positions of political power for what goal. That's what we, it seems to me, need to address in this country. This year is as good a place to begin as any because it is, after all, a watershed year, a year in which we get to decide whether we stay the course, as George Bush and Ronald Reagan said, continuing the policy of trickle-down economics, or whether we adopt a more inclusive policy in which all the people share the wealth, share the opportunity, share the responsibility. We need La Raza. We need the voice, the experience, most importantly, the moral authority of your community-based organizations more than we have ever needed it before. The change that we need in this country is not merely in programs, not merely in budgets. Rather, it is a fundamental change of attitude that we've got to have coming out of Washington, D.C. Just as you have led in the past at a local level, building up to national importance, shaping the national debate, now we've got to have you again leading and demanding that America begin to pay more than lip service to our fundamental values. What happened to talk about economic fairness? Let's talk again about social justice, about ethnic pluralism and equal opportunity. Too many politicians in my own party, which is Democratic, and just to save you the suspense, have found it inconvenient lately, in recent years, to stand firm for these old-time, little-d Democratic ideals. Too many progressive and liberal leaders have done the same. And as a result, our nation has suffered. We have slid backwards. There's a dicho down in South Texas among the Mexican-American shrimpers. Camarón que se duerme, se lo lleva la corriente. We've got to wake them up again, these politicians. We have got to demand again that these basic principles in our society become the standard by which we judge the performance of our economy, of our government, and ultimately of our society. This has been a bipartisan disaster, I would add. Republicans have led it since 1981, but too many Democrats have acquiesced. Too many Democrats have aided and abetted it. This whole enterprise has a fancy name. They don't call it trickle-down economics. They call it supply-side economics. But all that means is their side gets all the supplies, pretty much. You can put earrings on a hog, but you still can't hide the ugliness that's down under there, and that's pretty much what this policy amounts to. We enacted one phase of trickle-down. We made the rich richer. Then we forgot the second phase. The rich sure got richer. The Congressional Budget Office, as Congressman Lujan would tell you, issued a study earlier this year in which it found that as a result of the total impact of Reaganomics, 80% of American families are making less now than they were 10 years ago. The richest 10%, however, have enjoyed a 16% increase in their income. The richest 5% have enjoyed a 23% increase in their income. The richest 1% of American families have gone to the bank with a 50% increase in their income. An average increase for that top 1%, by the way, of $129,000 a year each that has put a big smile on their face. It's worse even when you look at the wealth distribution in our society. Income is only a part of wealth. In 1976, the richest 1% of American families owned 19% of all the wealth in our country. That's all the cash, all the stocks, all the bonds, all the artwork, all the real estate, everything in this country. Richest 1% own 19%. That's a lot, but by 1983, thanks to the Reagan Revolution, the richest 1% owned 34% of America's wealth. A doubling, practically, of the concentration of wealth in this society. Today, the richest 1% in our society own more than the bottom 90% of our people own combined. Who are those 1% of the people? There are families that have an average income of $500,000 or more a year. There are families that have an average net worth of $2.5 million a year. Honk if that's you. Maybe Alex here, but not. That's not America that is out there. Now, of course, they come back and they said, well, yes, the spread's gotten worse, but everybody's benefited because, as the president himself said, a rising tide lifts all boats. That's inspirational, isn't it? You probably heard the president say it in the State of the Union message, a rising tide lifts all boats. What Ronnie doesn't understand is not everybody's got a boat. There's His folks are out there at the yacht club right now. They're having a good time. They're eating fine pate, sipping good Cabernet. Big smile on their face. Morning in America for them. But the majority of Americans are stopping off down to 7-Eleven, pick up a tall bud and a bag of chicharrones, wondering who's going to reach out to us for a change. Where's our help coming from? Who's going to invest in us? It's been morning in America for them, but it's the morning after for the rest of us out here. Well, that's because too much of it, as I say, going to absurd military spending. Let me read you something that Ann Landers reported on recently. She offered this quote, said that an American leader reported that U.S. is first in military spending, first in military technology, first in total global military bases and naval fleets, first in number of nuclear bombs and warheads, but we rank 7th in life expectancy. We rank 10th in spending for public education per student, 14th in proportion of population with access to safe water, 17th in infant mortality. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. That's not Jesse Jackson speaking. That's not Ted Kennedy, some radical like Tony Anaya talking. That's Dwight David Eisenhower in 1957 making that comment. It just makes sense. We have an economic policy that is based on the greed of the few, costing us the genius of the many in that process. Real people suffer as a result of these distorted priorities. Since 1979, there's been a 30% increase in the number of Hispanic households with poverty-level incomes or less. Since 1979, there's been a 60% increase in the number of Hispanic children living in poverty. But it's not just poor folks. It's also middle-class people who've been falling into poverty. I deal with those dirt farmers out there in the country. 650,000 have lost their farms since 1981. That's 20% of the farms and ranches in this country, struck down in a stunningly brief period of time. And those who remain are on the brink of broke. An old boy out in West Texas told me you can still make a small fortune in agriculture. The problem is you got to start with a large fortune. That's not really the way this thing ought to be working, but that is the way that it is working. Farmers who 7 years ago would have opposed the food stamp program, the cheese distribution program, are now in line to get food stamps, in line to get cheese allocations. Working families, they've been the hardest hit. The biggest increase in poverty has come not from people who are on welfare, it's come from the working poor. Had a 50% increase in people who go to work every single day and come home with poverty pay. Farm workers, you deal with them. They're out there in the earliest dawn, doing the hardest work, the nastiest work, the most risky work, and they go home after a long and difficult day with poverty pay. In grand buildings like this, in hotels, you'll find at the close of business at night, another crew comes in. This building isn't vacant. The charwomen come in. The janitors come in. And they work a long, hard night, back-breaking kind of work, long work, and they go home with poverty pay. Again and again, within our society, strong minority of people who are being forced to take pay that is beneath what we ought to be offering. Yet we, in this society, in the last few years, have been knocking their wages down. What does it say about our respect for work, our admiration of the work ethic, when we say to a worker, we're going to knock you down from $18 an hour to $10 an hour. Now go to work and feel better about it. What does that say to that person? And what does it mean to the family income? What it means is now the spouse has got to go to work. So the spouse goes out and gets a $4 job, a minimum wage job. So now two people are working, earning $14 when one person was able to make an income of $18 before. Downward mobility, a destruction of the spirit of that family. Got to put the kid in daycare. The buying power of the family knocked off. They can't now buy the products that are in the factories manufacturing. It is a downward mobility that makes no sense. Minimum wage. We're having some sort of an argument in Washington that is beyond my comprehension as to whether we ought to raise the minimum wage from $3.35 an hour to as high as something as radical as $5 an hour. $3.35 an hour, full-time work, 40 hours a week. That means you earn $6,900 a year. Yet we're having an argument as to whether this is economically feasible. It's not a matter of economics, it's a matter of justice. It's what kind of people we're going to be. We must raise the minimum wage. We've had all the Reaganomics we can stand. Reagamortis is setting in on the countryside here. We've got to get to work. We've got to turn from this policy of degradation and turn to an enlightened policy of motivation of all the people, based on a new investment initiative for Americans themselves, all Americans. We get there by participating and asserting ourselves in the public dialogue, as you have done in the past. But we must broaden those coalitions now. National Council El Raza needs to meet with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. It needs to meet with the National Farmers Union, needs to meet with the AFL-CIO, needs to meet with the national environmental organizations, consumer organizations, put us all together. Barbara Jordan once said, we might not all come over on the same boat, but we're in the same boat now. And we might as well recognize that, and we might as well team up so that we get a grassroots program of economic growth in this country based on our own people. And in addition to building those coalitions, we must then assert ourselves. We must go on the offensive. I don't, again, need to tell you that we have really spent all of our energies and most of our resources these last several years being on the defensive, having to fight negative battles, fighting cutbacks in the programs of benefit to people, fighting the racism that was within that immigration reform legislation, fighting the ugliness, the small-mindedness of the English-only movement. We don't need English only, we need English plus. I mean, who are we? I think people will recognize that across the country if we assert ourselves in that debate. Your ancestors were here before Americans were. You were here before America was America. When Columbus came to this country, when the Mayflower hit the land, it was your ancestors saying, bienvenidos. That was your first mistake, by the way, but nonetheless, there it was. In Texas, I advocate, instead of doing away with bilingual education, that we need to extend bilingual education to the majority population. We all need to speak both languages. It makes us a richer people, a richer culture, better citizens of the world. But now's the time to form those coalitions and to go on the offensive with our issues. And finally, the most important thing is to keep that faith. We just celebrated the 4th of July in this country. And as Andy indicated, the Declaration of Independence of 1776 was not a declaration for the majority of the people. Women could not vote. They were considered chattel. Slaves were, of course, property. Indians were savages. Non-property owners were not full citizens. The majority could not participate. What we celebrate on the 4th of July is not the document, but the long 212-year struggle to democratize that document. That is what the National Council of La Raza represents. You are very much in step with that long history of people who have made that battle. The people who battled slavery, the populace who battled concentrations of wealth in the late 1800s, the Wobblies who organized and provided the leadership to create the national labor organizations that we have now, the suffragettes, on and on right through the environmental movement. That spirit resides within the hearts of each of us in that room. That spirit is what is going to democratize and create progress for this country. We walk with heroes that have passed on: Benito Juarez, Martin Luther King, Willie Velasquez. Willie Velasquez, if he were here, he would say to you, wouldn't he, Andy, don't mourn, organize. That's our program. We have it within ourselves to build a democracy, and we must continue to make that fight. Let me leave you with this observation, because it sums up what I think our struggle is all about. This is from Martin Luther King in 1963, when he was in the Birmingham jail and wrote his letters from that jail. He said that history is the long and tragic story of the fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privilege voluntarily. We must come to see that human progress never rolls on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of men and women. We must forever realize that the time is always ripe to do right. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy. I'm proud to work with National Council of Raza on that long struggle. Thank you very much.
Fantastic.